Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Kelly Tatham, and I'm here today with Ian Ebright, who is a filmmaker, a writer-director based in Seattle, not too far from where I am. I'm currently in what is known as Burnaby, British Columbia. So we're just a short drive from each other across a few colonial checkpoints. And so the land that I'm on was, we're both on the same land, traditionally stewarded by the Coast Salish peoples. Vancouver is Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territory, but it's also Stolo territory and K'Kite and many other nations that, again, span down to the land that you're on. So I wanted to acknowledge that because we're going to be talking about your film, The Way We Speak, which is your first feature film. And in preparing for this interview, I watched all of your shorts. And
Oh, I appreciate that.
oh, of course. I was really excited. Well, there's so much to talk about because I don't know if it was your second short, but it's the second short that's listed on your website, The Devil Needs a Fix.
Yeah.
I'd actually seen before.
Weird. Well, that's nice to hear.
Well, I saw it in theaters. I saw it at festivals when I was touring my film.
Wow, that's trippy. Do you remember the festival? I won't.
Did it play in Portland?
Yes.
I
Were
saw it
you at
there.
Portland Film
I was in
Festival?
Portland. Yeah.
That's really eerie. That's eerie because you had like a I'm only saying this now, and it sounds like, I'm saying it because I'm in front of you, but like you had a familiar vibe. I think it was that like we've seen each other's face before in what would have been like 7 years prior.
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. Portland. That one didn't play too many, so I know that one was at Portland. And you have one there. Which film of yours was there?
Multiverse dating for beginners.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I remember seeing your film and being really struck by it. And coming away with mixed feelings. Not in like the quality of the film, but in the message of the film, being like, oh, what was being said there and how do I feel about it? And
Yeah.
that was
That makes me happy. That's I think what I'm aiming for is like I like to say bittersweet. That is definitely not a bittersweet story. I also think of my shorts. I kind of pulled my punch on that one. I think that one I owed the audience a line that was not in there. But hopefully it resonated. I still like that you felt complicated. Like I think that's more or less I always like to my favorite films have always been the ones where like I'm like, okay, I think I know their theme and point of view, but I feel stirred up in a way that, that to me that's like good cinema. So I like that you feel that way.
yeah, I think that's the purpose of art is to provoke us and make us feel things. Like right now, we get pretty spoon-fed, at least with blockbuster films, of like just
Totally.
feel good or like, kind of comfortable and safe at the end, and it doesn't actually move the
Totally.
consciousness.
Well, it's like you were saying about acknowledging the land that we're on. We're like this, we have lived through sort of this rapid changing landscape in North America, in both good and bad ways. And sometimes the good is kind of co-opted by this kind of corporate like fear-based thing where it's like, I mean, on paper, cool, but is this just for you to benefit your bottom line? So it can get a little confusing, sort of sorting through things and like, not only finding like the right thing, but that it's done for the right reasons, that there's an authenticity to it and it's not just about us kind of covering our bases, which is a little gross.
Yeah, it wasn't devised in a marketing room of like, what's going to hit the most
100%.
demographics?
Yeah, it's a real thing. I come from marketing. I have horror stories. So
Oh, gosh.
yeah, it's as real. And before that, I come from contaminated litigation going up against, some of the biggest multinational companies that you and I would both know. And, to read the arguments they put forward in court is shocking. It really kind of like washed away my naivete or whatever. Because yeah, like money and power, unfortunately it kind of leads to sinister things at times in these big companies. So yeah, it's interesting that you said that because there's a lot of that's correct, but I still feel icky. Like you feel like you're being manipulated. And there is unfortunately some of that.
Yeah. I think our right to comfort, we believe that we're meant to be comfortable in the Western society because that's how it's been set up to make us comfortable,
Right.
often at the expense of people in other places. Which brings me to your first short film, From the Sky,
Oh.
which I found was so powerful and it was so surprising after. So I watched, I saw The Way We Speak and then I realized I'd seen The Devil Needs a Fix. And then I watched From the Sky and I was like, oh wow, this is quite different. And yet also I can see that you're grappling with the same bigger picture questions.
Thanks. Yeah, that's really nice to hear. Yeah, I can say more about that one. I mean, it's kind of along the lines that we're talking about. I remember reading this. I mean, I'm going to be like really political, and if you don't want me to, I can avoid it. I remember reading this article in The Atlantic about like our foreign policy. And, you know, it was George Bush and like Cheney that lost a generation of conservatives. I was born and raised like conservative Christian, so I was all in. And then I remember, even by the definition of conservative, those guys were kind of an abomination. They lost me and a lot of people. And so Obama presented an alternative, you know, that we were excited about. And I remember as certain foreign policy things escalated under him, which none of us wanted to see, there was a great article in The Atlantic. And they were talking about like the New York Times kill list, which was basically saying like Obama was a constitutional law professor, and he and John Brennan, unlike Bush and Cheney, who were more like, you know, outsourcing it to the CIA, they would pore over these dossiers and sort of make the calls themselves. And it was trying to say that although this has accelerated these drone strikes, it weighs heavily on them. And the really great takeaway from the Atlantic was something like, I don't know, isn't it kind of Western and a little gross of us that, you know, we get to excuse whatever we want to do because we were troubled by it. And that really like found me at the right time. And there was like shows like 24 and all this stuff where it was saying, hey, it was sort of like popularizing the Cheney thing of you've got to break a few eggs to make an omelet, which is, you know, not what we do in a civilized society. And heroizing that. So I wanted to make the anti-24, you know, in a short film, which is a small blip compared to the reach of that. But we got Middle Eastern advisors involved, men and women of different walks and faiths from the Middle East. And yeah, it felt not right, but like, I mean, it felt a little right. More, it felt interesting of like, what would it be like to live under it rather than how does it hurt our precious Western feelings? Which, you know, the older I get, I'm like, I'm not so sure that's the question when it comes to the damage we're capable of doing. So anyway, that's a little bit of where that one came from, because I loved that idea of it's just not sufficient to say I was troubled by something that I did. There's still the fact that it was done and there was fallout. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thoughtful people should be wrestling with that. And I thought it would be a good story. So,
yeah, I found it really powerful because you said it in the Middle East and it's in the Arabic language. And it's the story of this young man and his father who meet two people while they're out, migrating across the land. They don't have a safe space. It's suggested that their family is gone. It's been destroyed by the military apparatus. And you also reference Zionists in the film. And so, you know, it was made back in 2014, and here we are 10 years later, and everyone knows what Zionism is, or at least has it in their consciousness in a way that we didn't 10 years ago. So I immediately thought of Palestine. But it's not specified in the film where it's set, but it's very clear that we're being placed in the point of view of someone who has to deal with the immediacy of war and the outcome of our need for comfort in the West, like you're saying. Like,
really good way to actually, that I think you're saying it, that's a good way to say it. Yeah, the like almost don't ask, don't tell thing, you know, exported, where it's like, oh, just don't trouble me with the details, I just want my little cocoon in the West.
And exactly
that, yeah, has collateral damage.
And you showed that, and you were also asking a big question in that of like, what is the value of resistance and where does resistance lead to? And I didn't feel like you were asking the viewer to take one side or another, which,
oh, that's nice to hear.
Which is also, you know, we can speak to your feature, The Way We Speak, which is, it's about a debate about whether or not God exists, two people debating these two sides. And so like, that's a clear theme through your work is, you know, holding this larger context, and from the sky, it's showing life in the Middle East under warfare and asking like, how do you resist that? And what does that do to a person? And hopefully opening up viewers in the West who don't have to deal with the immediacy of that, but like planting that seed of like, where do we go? And I've written about this in my work about like third spaces. And I know that makes some people roll their eyes, but like,
I'm not sure I know what that is. Say more about that.
So like this idea of like, there's two options, like resistance or just accepting what is. And so what's the third space? Is there a way between? And so I feel like that's kind of bubbling up through your work.
I really like that. I mean, that's it's nice to hear you say that, because I like writing things that are pokey. You know, I like to be pokey in the stuff that I write, but I think if that's like where a film leaves people, I think that needs to be like, just kind of as a aspiring writer, I feel like anything pokey or any, you know, I owe it to the audience to give each side its best argument, almost as like the writing 101 adage. And I want to explore this stuff and sort of like get under people's skin, hopefully. But then I also feel like as a story, the stuff that has the best shelf life for me doesn't feel like that's its primary goal. That it like is walking and chewing gum in the way of also leaving it to the audience to, you know, that we don't hand them their opinion at the end. Like, I think, which is weird, because you could say those two things are opposed, like being pokey, which is I have a point of view that I want to make as a filmmaker, but I also want the story to somehow be above that point. Or I feel that, yeah, that it's almost a lesser story, and I've put it in a time capsule. You know, if it's just making its point and not telling like almost a more universal story, I think that's a disservice. So it's kind of trying to do, you know, contradicting things at the same time, like a little bit of a paradox, which is like, say something and let people explore on their own. Like, it's kind of my gripe with a lot of cinema. I often feel like I'm being taken on like a amusement park ride tour of this A-list director. And it reminds me of Scorsese's great line where he's like, I never go back to films for their plot ever. He's like, I only go back for like the relatability of the stories and the characters, which is such a great like guiding light of, okay, you had 1,000 twists and, you know, you outsmarted me, but now that I've seen it, you turn the lights on in the funhouse, like, I'm not going to go back to this. This was just me being impressed with you. And like, speaking for me, I think that's not what we're supposed to be doing as storytellers. It's like the opposite, like it's for the audience. So I appreciate both of like, that you came away with attention for it, but also that there's stuff worth chewing on. Trying to juggle that is fun.
It's interesting that you referenced Scorsese and you're talking about like the amusement park ride that, and I haven't seen Megapolis yet, but it's been kind of, and we don't need to go there, but I do think there is a tie to your film.
Yes. Robert Schaefer is that film's editor and my film's editor. So it was very interesting that, and I think he's one of the reasons like the way we speak does not play like a ultra low budget film. Like, there's a couple people that I would name and he's one of them. But yeah, he was kind of editing the most expensive indie film of their last, you know, maybe 20 years or something. And one of the cheapest at the same time.
That's epic. Yeah, so it's so well paced. And I saw someone referenced you as similar to Aaron Sorkin.
That was nice. I mean, so that wasn't in the cards for me. Like, it's appreciated. I remember when like Ebert was, when we got reviewed by RogerEbert.com, like that was one of those moments of like, oh, because like the film itself is based on a couple documentaries. And one of them is Life Itself, which was about the film critic Roger Ebert. I was born and raised. Those guys were like parents to me. Like, I've watched that show so religiously. And speaking of ethics, like I was talking to a friend recently about like slasher films. And I always thought Ebert had a really amazing barometer. He was never a prude. He never came at it from like my background, which was like the sort of censorship, religious prude argument. It was a more open-handed thing, but he was still really willing to say like, this piece of filmmaking is like just sadistic for sadistic sake and doesn't raise the discourse. I always loved him for that. So yeah, it was Life Itself and Best of Enemies were the two documentaries that like influenced me in writing The Way We Speak. And when they reviewed it and mentioned that, it was like one of those nice moments.
They say you have to like take the criticism with the praise. If you got to believe all of it. So, but
yes. And as the universe would have it, there was immediately after that moment where we, you know, you and I were talking about like, you know, we go back to regular life after festivals, right? There's always some splash of cold water after the high. which like is never comfortable, but I think it's probably healthy for us to have like a dose of humility. You know, the review after that is never going to be good. It's going to be like, I don't know, it was okay. And, you know, they're just sort of slicing it up. So I don't know, it's good for us. Because I think you're right. Like we, you know, we fall too in love with one review, then we're going to have to take all of them at face value.
Sure. And I think the point is not getting too in your head, like your lead character in The Way We Speak, played by Patrick Fabian, Simon Harrington, who's this very arrogant. That's kind of an unkind word. I really like the character, you know.
Well, I'm so glad that you're willing to say that, because anyway, go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you, but.
Well, you know, it's interesting because he's played by, I don't know if the character is about in his 50s or so, but he's up and coming. And so we don't see that very often. We see a lot of young people and up and coming, and they're more kind of the ingenue type, and we have a lot more empathy for them in their pride. But this older man who's very prideful about his work, I understood that, you know, of like, God, I just want to be seen. I want to be validated. I want my ideas to be heard. And people are starting to hear his ideas for the first time, and it's intoxicating to him. And you craft that really well in the opening of the film, really showing how he places that above everything else in his life. And that sort of, I think, you know, if you start taking all the reviews to heart, you're like, well, I am Sorkin. It's like, well, okay, no, you don't want to be Sorkin. You want to be, you know, we're inspired by these incredible filmmakers. And, you know, if you have a dialogue heavy film that still feels fast paced and dynamic while mostly being talking, then like, that's great to be compared to Sorkin, because that's, you know, he does that very well.
Well, it's funny, even in the Ebert review, even in what was overall positive review, he dings me of like, you know, this has some of the benefits of a Sorkin film and some of the detractions. And like, of course, we're all biased to our own thing. I think I have an answer for that. But even in his praise, it's like, yeah, Sorkin's not great at certain things, and this film might suffer from that too. So it's like, yeah, it's always like intention of like, okay, you know, like not to get, it's very Star Wars, right? Like not to be seduced by whatever the praise or the allure is of like, take it in check. I like that, if I can fit, I love that you like him. And I just, you know, I'll say that was like a goal of ours. I hate test screenings. You know, we've done them for all of my films. I get depressed every time. And, you know, like I think us artists are, like, I'm a very sensitive, perceptive person. I'm very like, I think writers are perceptive. I don't know how you would write unless you were perceptive. And so I don't always perceive correctly, but like test screenings, I hate them, but they're valuable. So we did it with The Way We Speak. And there was such like a, in certain corners, there was such a revulsion to Simon, which I understand. And it, again, it was helpful because we went back, Robbie, the editor and I went back, we called it like our softening Simon tour. And we looked for places, and what we found is there are just, he's got a quip and a response for everything. And it's a little bit like these movies I was referencing with Ebert of like, you know, nonstop, like a grindhouse stuff where it's like, I just become numbed out at some point when it's too, it could be gore or it could be this arrogant person or whoever that you're saying. So we built in like a couple places, like in the, memorial where he learns the surprise about Sarah, his antagonist, and her connection to the thing. And I'd written, and we have it filmed, that he has a quip, and we took that out, and he just sort of backs away. In other words, Simon, with all of his, you know, gabbing, is able to be silenced by being hurt, and that helps humanize him. So as much as I hate and get depressed from feedback screening, it was really helpful. And I'm glad that you felt he's relatable, because that was kind of we had a lot of conversations about how do we stick with this really problematic dude? Because hopefully, the audience is neither above him or below him. I mean, they can be certainly at times, but like that the holistic experience is, if I'm honest, that reminds me as an audience member of relationships I've been in and aspects of myself that I maybe don't want to examine. Like that's kind of a win for us. So that was the goal, but it's hard, because somebody said to me, I just don't want to watch a movie about another like old white guy. And I'm like, that's a hard position to rebut. Like I kind of, being the straight white dude that I am, and I can't know that fully, I'm kind of like, I get it. There's been a lot of these stories. So how do we do it again in a way that's hopefully timely enough that it's not like finger wagging or just, you know, like eye rolling for people of like, enough, we've seen these guys, you know?
Well, I felt like that he was very honest and authentic to like who he was as a character. Like he was a very well fleshed out character where like, I don't want to see another story with some old white dude who's just like painted as a hero. And we're not actually like looking at his flaws, you know? I think there's value, there's so much. And I think more than anything, we need stories about white dudes where we're like unpacking how they got to where they are and why they do the things they do. And like, you know, maybe giving them a dose of humility along the way.
I love that. That sounds very similar to my consulting producer, Jess Grant, said like, you know, without revealing her politics, but like, you know, she kind of played against type, was like, I'm into the story because it's kind of about exploring what we do with the rest of the guys. What do we do with all the, I mean, this is, it's not a movie about Harvey Weinstein, you know, but like, it's a movie made with an awareness of Me Too and Black Lives Matter and these recent shifts that we've seen. And that reminds me a little bit of what you're saying of, you know, where like, as Patrick says, very humbly, that I love, is like, he will say himself, both Simon and I, Ian, would also add, like, we're still in school on this stuff. So we're still learning in real time. And, you know, we come with baggage and we make mistakes. And I thought it was interesting because Mad Men has been done very well before to, you know, I'm not going to out Mad Men. That show, it did that. We've seen guys enjoying their cigarettes and telling the attractive woman to go get him a cup of coffee. But what if, you know, with these things, these headlines we see of men dropping out like flies from college, and that it literally is becoming like a woman's workplace. And some of these movements are beginning to like give more equal footing. That less about being correct. It sounded really interesting to put a man in the shadow of three successful women, and that would really force some of his weaknesses to the forefront. So that's, I always feel relieved when I hear people respond to the film like you did, because we knew we were high, you know, high wire, kind of tightrope walking it, but it felt worth doing and kind of interesting, something I hadn't seen before. Like, not just, I think to your point, either let's get this guy or, you know, the white hero, which is like, I don't know who those movies are for, you know what I mean?
For the numb masses, perhaps.
yeah.
But, you know, we get a lot of anti-heroes, especially in television. And, you know, these guys out there on their own individual missions. And, you know, Simon's on his individual mission, and he's an intellectual, and he's an atheist, and he's very set in his ways, which I think is very interesting to explore, because, you know, you're asking the question in the debate, like, does God exist? And on those of us who are, you know, so-called progressives on the left, like, there has been this sort of almost demonizing of religion, or, you know, refusing to talk about God, or not being willing to, you know, hold a bigger picture, or hold like what I would call a multiverse of perspectives. And so, you know, to put him in the center, and then you have these beautiful moments, like these dream moments throughout the film that felt very religious, for lack of a better word, or spiritual, or like, you know, with the water, and like water being, you know, source and spirit just like coming woven through the film, like waking him up.
Weird that you said that, because my sound designer, Brendan Hogan, I don't know if you saw my third short, Pinwheel Horizon, but he's like, he did the sound for that and for this. And he's like, what's up with you and water? And I was like, oh boy, I usually have an answer. I have no idea. And he said something similar to you, where he's like, I'm here for it. I don't know what it's about, though, but it seems to have like some, whether it's biblical or spiritual, or like some thing that you're putting in there. I was like, I wasn't aware of it. I mean, clearly it's set and there's, you know, it's happening, but it's one of the parts of the story where I'm like, oh, I was thinking more character wise and what can we pull off for cheap that has like a visual bang. But I love that you said that. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, Claire's line, his wife in it, where, when Deanna, the actor that plays Claire, when we were talking, you know, as the film reveals, she herself is also an atheist, but goes about it very differently than him. And we were kind of talking like, yeah, she would probably say she's having this Zen kind of awakening thing. You know, it's almost like the comedian Patton Oswalt. It's like, I don't believe in God, but maybe there's like an intelligence, a lattice work of intelligence. You know, it's just kind of that I've been through, life has hit me between the eyes, and I feel like I'm kind of loosening my fist a little bit to be open to things. And we thought that was Claire. And yeah, maybe those dreams for Simon are a little bit of that, which in his case would be troubling to him, you know, because unlike Claire, he wants to get rid of all of that and just do what he's good at and follow it all the way to the finish line. And any of that, you know, the kind of caution and warnings and troublings of whether it's the women around him or those dreams, it's like that for him is noise, you know, and kind of leads to his undoing. So I like those. I'm glad you like them too.
Yeah, I think Simon doesn't know that he is worshiping a god. I
Yeah.
think
No, I like that. Say more though.
just the way that anti-theism has become its own theism, or this refusal to acknowledge the power of belief and how that shapes us, and we can all place something on our altar and worship it.
So with you. I feel like you, I want to hear more, but I, that's like, that's so dangerously close to what we, why we made the film, which is like, it's a little bit of the niche quote. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but you know, careful if you look into the abyss because it'll look into you. And like, I'm a big believer of like, not just pride comes before the fall, but like being self-referential, which is what I think I hear you saying, and correct me if not, but any of these communities that are like defined by what they're against, and in some ways, like overcorrect, you know, maybe it sounds like your description of this progressive thing where it has no, it doesn't hold a space for any of that because it's overcorrecting against like the admittedly toxic overreach of organized religion or whatever. Then it has created a self-referential community of its own. And then it's kind of in jeopardy of doing the same thing that it came from. So I'm with what I think you're describing, which is wrestling with some of these ambiguities and things. You know, like we'll all land in different conclusions and convictions based on our experience. But I don't know. The older I get, the more, you know, it's I'm surprised how much like a mystical approach informs my day to day. Like I thought I was just going to be the didactic guy who knew everything and would like basically Simon, you know. And I find that life, you know, has challenged that out of me. And I don't know, and it's yeah, I don't know how people go through loss and these really like, you know, all these next level seasons that find us all. I shouldn't say that. I do get it, but it makes me sad when people come out the other end doubling down, because whatever language we put to God or universe or however it does or doesn't work, I kind of believe in that muse or artist thing, and that it's like it's inviting us to be more human, you know, and that if we, it's like, you know, and since we all went through COVID and all of these like seismic things, you know, and every once in a while we'll come across these people who seems like self-awareness hasn't started yet, and it's like this was the season for that, you know. I mean, we're all grieving. That's that, yeah, there's definitely some of that in the film. I think that's what we aspire to make, is a film that's like the enemy isn't Christianity or atheism, it's certainty. And it's particularly you know, like we can have like, I hear my therapist in my head and how much she helped me of like, well, that's how you feel. So like sometimes we do need to fight and argue, and like it's not an anti-passion film, but carrying that to the point that everyone is just like your cannon fodder, you know, that it's like I'm just, I mean, yeah, in the political allegory kind of way, I'm just gonna manipulate and use and sort of exploit everything to get where I need to go. And I feel like there's a lot of that, unfortunately, not just like at the political levels, you know, but like kind of everywhere. I think for the reason you described of like we get hurt, you know, collectively, and we find new groups that have stepped away, and then we end up building that thing again. I that worries me.
Yeah, me too. I think the certainty and the comfort go hand in hand. It's uncomfortable to accept that it's vast out there, that it's unknown, that there's actually no ground to stand on. Or maybe there's some ground. Like, I think that's a bigger conversation about morality and like a civilized society. Like, how do we want to show up and like what do we agree upon? But because we're living in a multiverse of experiences, you know, you and I are having similar experiences here in the West. But someone on the other side of the planet is having an experience that we can't even fathom, or that, you know, you can imagine in your film, you can find your way
Awesome.
in there.
Yeah.
But someone down the street from us too is also having a totally different experience. And even you and I, with, you know, both being white filmmakers with Christian backgrounds, we're also having just like completely divergent experiences and seeing the world in a different way. And I think being with that requires grief. It requires like allowing the water to move through us, like bringing back in the water metaphor, like grief. Like this, my favorite author, Lydia Yuknovich, said, talks about the river of grief that runs through all of us. And I think when we can't open ourselves up to that, we turn to certainty. And certainty becomes this sort of like, well, I'm not in a river. I'm going to stand on the side of the land and I'm going to be determined. When it's like really, you know, for me, my personal opinion, if there that God is a conscious intelligence that flows through all of us, you know, maybe this interwoven thread, and that like it has to keep moving and it has to keep growing. And as soon as we want to stake our claim, like this land is Canada, like it belongs to us, you know, it's like you can make that up for a time, you can set those policies in place, you can draw those borders, but like the river is going to come and take it sooner or later.
That is not only well said, it's like eerily close to something that has kind of been knocking on my shoulder lately. Like I really, yeah, because I do that myself where I like to be self-reliant and get busy, you know? So that's my version of staking my claim, which is just I'll be self-reliant and have high expectations for myself and just be busy. And similarly to the thing we're talking about, like the, you know, the certainty, I feel like life, whatever you want to call it, like challenges that because it's sort of it's a rigidity, you know. And like whenever I'm out like in nature or something, or we see the leaves changing, I'm like, oh right, this change thing is not only constant, but there's like this fluidity to nature. And I'm supposed to be able to kind of embody that. And I don't as often as I should because I get comfort from being like, this thing will look like this. And then life kind of it breaks it up. So I really agree with you. There's it feels like there's this like cosmic effort to, you know, I mean, it's like in our film too, what Claire says at the end when she gets that great, she finally, as I think the voice of the audience gets to tell Simon what we've all been feeling. And she's like, you know, careful what you say out loud because the universe is listening. Like there is this kind of you know, in my experience of one person, like when the point we're willing to say it's going to be like this or I am this, it's life kind of gets interested and is like, really, you're sure it's gonna okay. Yeah, I like the way you said that.
Thanks. Yeah, I think, you know, it's be careful what you say. The universe is listening. I find that to be so true because we're always shaping the world. And I understand why people are why people want to throw God away, because this God narrative, like the Judeo-Christian, like the Catholic Church God narrative, has shaped the world. It's the reason why the West was colonized, like Doctrine of Discovery. They're like, oh, if there's no Christians here, the land is empty. So just like go right ahead, you know? Like and we can't separate that from God, even if you and I have different definitions of God, even if other religions and faiths have different definitions of God, the reality is like the matrix or the paradigm, like the society that we live in, is shaped by that specific narrative. So of course people want to throw it away. It's been so destructive, but God is bigger than that. And I love what the Octavia Butler wrote in The Parable of the Sower, God is change. And that feels true in so many ways, especially today when things are changing so rapidly. But like, what are we missing if we don't have these conversations? You know, in your film, Simon wanted to shut, like, there was no, I mean, he's in a debate, he's arguing for his side, and Claire's arguing for the other side, but there was no, you know, no humility there to think, like, well, what if I'm wrong, or what if we're both right, or what if it's something in between?
Yeah, and it kind of, you know, in, like you're saying, of the film, well, they have a job to do, because it's like the nature of, we want to win the 50,000 and blah, 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 use the stepping stone. I think that's kind of like a challenge for all of us. Like I was saying about me, as open-handed as I like to view myself, like my brand of that is kind of busy, which I think is true in the film too, of like everything is so accelerated, it feels like, that we can kind of like justifiably and somewhat understandably like blame it on, you know, I don't have time to hold that. Like, you know, it's like I just have to get from A to Z. And yeah, we're all on, this is my sense, I could be wrong, but whether we're sort of marketed to be this way or it's really like the result of the work-life balance and cost of living stuff, we're all on such a hamster wheel that it is getting harder, although it's still our responsibility to, like, you know, find a more thoughtful way. It's almost like, oh, I don't know, just lowest common denominator, because I just got to get it done, you know? And if we're just always in that posture of like, then we make a lot of compromises, you know, and miss out on what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's definitely a hamster wheel. And like, you see people waking up to deeper and deeper awareness of what's happening on the planet and how they don't want to be in these systems, but nobody, or a lot of people, don't know what to do about it. Like, I feel like I'm a person who's constantly trying to do things about it, and still I'm like, I don't know what to do about it.
Totally. Yeah.
Tell it's stories, funny. I guess.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, with your example of, you know, regardless of what people think of Jesus, I think it's interesting that, you know, even people who don't believe in the Christian sense, like, respect him as a prophet or an icon. And like, you know, the fact that whatever trouble he got into, that he resorted to stories. Like, there's wisdom in that for me. Of, you know, we can even look to these greats of, well, surely they had the answer all the time. And it kind of reads to me like they were like, if you say it on the nose, like, you know, we know what happens to him, right? Like, for, you know, he got in good trouble or whatever it's called. Like, even he had the wherewithal to be like, you just can't come in the front door and just say what it is. Like, people aren't, that's my takeaway, obviously, like that yeah, we almost get to hide this. My storytelling teacher would call it, like, you know, survival information, and his point is that, you know, stories have been told since we were in caves, because it was literally about, I'm going to write on the wall that this thing that looks like a tiger will shred you to pieces if you go in the high grass. And so, like, the responsibility for you and I is, like, we either warn people about poison, or we put medicine, survival information in our stories. And yeah, you know, these icons use story, and that we can use stories as almost like a, you know, Trojan horse to slip in some medicine is probably good, because I feel like we're all collectively so savvy, and I think we all have good, like, BS detectors. Like, we're all very opposed to being directly confronted. You know, it's like this, it gives us, maybe to your third way thing, it gives us a space where we can, like, actually agree to sit down and, like, kind of like sports. It's like, all right, we'll still, people from opposing teams will still go and sit in the same arena. That's good. But we don't have a lot of those things anymore. And, like, film is another one of those, of like, all right, I'll sit down and, like, my team might lose, I might get provoked by what your story's saying, but it's, so I'm with you. I used to be like, I used to blog on faith and human rights, and I don't know if it's middle age or what, or, you know, going through some grief myself, but I'm like, I don't see the efficacy. For me personally, I think it's arrogant of me, and I don't believe I've gotten the results I've wanted by trying to you know, kind of do what the film does, which is like wrestle people to the floor intellectually, if that makes sense. It's like, I got to kind of wrap it in, you know, like, just load it up with sugar, you know, so that, but there's a little bit in there. Cause yeah, we're all moving quick, and it's like, I don't know, who are you to come in here and, like, disrupt my worldview, unless we package it in a certain way. So.
Yeah, a lot of people don't, they're not looking for their worldview to be interrupted. Maybe they don't even know they have a worldview. Like,
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
They're just moving through the day, just being like, well, this is it. And
yeah.
All of a sudden someone's like, well, this is a different worldview. And they're like, no, I can't even compute that because that's too far outside of my perspective.
I guess you're right. Like I like project that is has some such meaning for me. I think since some recent loss and grief where kind of learning that that's a companion, I don't know. I don't know. That has always been a desire of mine. I think I could talk more about it and we would get into like parents and stuff. But, you know, being around enough people who I watched not know themselves, I incorrectly assume that everyone's like me, which is like, I watched how awful that was. So I would like to never be done learning and being, you know, provoked in some way. And it seems like why people read, you know, we want to like Ebert's thing about film, like this empathy machine. It's like, I want to be expanded because I was in a family where it was what you're describing, Kelly, of resistance to anything other than, you know, the script. And I watched that lead nowhere good. So, but I guess you're right. I then, Ian, project that. I'm like, I assume everyone's doing that. But I guess that's not true. I guess sometimes there's such a, you know, tornado inside or perceived tornado outside that people just, they don't have the constitution to feel additionally troubled or stirred up. It's like, I'm already stirred up enough, or the world stirred up enough. I don't want, you know, it's like my thing with being busy. It's like, I need to erect a fence and have some form to this. But to me, that's like, kind of like what makes life worth living is I'm on a journey. I would be scared to be like, oh, I arrived 7 years ago. It's been amazing ever since.
Those are just the billionaires who are just like, okay, now we'll go to the moon. And then like,
yeah.
Everything's, I don't need to change. I don't need to look inside.
Totally. Yeah, for sure.
So what was the, walk me through what made you write this film? It's interesting going back and seeing your first short, which is political, religious as well, but it felt more political, like a commentary on war. And then you made a film about, you know, a deal with the devil, or, you know, or not taking a deal with the devil, what that might look like. And then I did watch Pinwheel Horizon, and it's a little bit more sci-fi fantasy, and also asking questions of kind of like, where is my place in a power struggle, and where do I stand up and where do I let go? And like, what is the outcome, or what is this wholeness, this fulfillment that I'm searching for? And then you landed with The Way We Speak, which is clearly informed by your background. But I'm curious about that trajectory, and also if you want to speak to it, where you stand with your faith today and how that informed it.
I will tell you offline, but not for your listeners, only because I'm kind of the belief that you know, I can talk up to an extent, but I feel like the film works better if, you know, if anyone who heard this and I'm like, I'm a this or a that, I think they would go look for the theme behind the theme. And we've really set out to make a film that, if anything, we had fun frustrating those expectations where, okay, is it going to throw red meat to this? Is it going to, you know, sort of demonize this? And we do that in like fits and starts, but ultimately we were kind of trying to show that both the Christian and the atheist were two sides of the same coin. To your first question, I wrote, so The Way We Speak had existed before Pinwheel Horizon. And, so like the newest screenplay other than what I'm writing now is Pinwheel Horizon. And, that one was very, very much about my dad dying. And that of all my three shorts and feature, that one is the most like God's in the mix a little bit, except in that one, I think it's totally about God. And it's weirdly, probably personal, hopefully in a way that works. I think I like that short more than most people. But that is how it felt when my dad died. He was sick for 30 years. He was Washington State's first liver transplant. And I mistakenly thought, okay, at the end of this long journey, when he finally does die, there's going to be some catharsis or connection or something to make up for the 30 years where I had the dad who like retreated into his illness, and like I, as the kid, the youngest brother, didn't get, like, my dad never told me who he was or who I was. And when he died, it was not that. It was someone leaving their body. And so that script kind of came out of that, of like some anger at God, some just some like, you know, feeling in, invisible in the family, and over the decades, receiving a lot of pity and well wishes, but always my dad was always the context. And like, you can grow to resent that, especially when that same person didn't see you. So to me, that one's very much about disillusionment, and the very scary thing of like acceptance, you know, which I think that film is ultimately about, and how God is there through all of that. But I feel, are you hearing our construction, by the way? Because it's having a moment.
Just a little bit. It's all
okay.
Good.
I'm so sorry.
So in terms of making your first feature, Why the Way We Speak, was it this story needed to be told, or was it this is what's producible right now, or a combination of the two?
Great question. I both. So I had a little bit of wherewithal of whenever I can make this, you know, small cast, reoccurring locations. I mean, I really wrote it to be achievable. And then ironically, we still have like 12 locations, and it blossomed as everything did. But yeah, it was like, I think I can do this. And it's, you know, it's not the scale is not large. And then the other thing was, you know, having a, you know, women in the house, wife and daughter, and we have, you know, these movements happening, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, and, you know, doing an imperfect job, but trying to listen better. And then really wondering what there was to say from my perspective, which I was kind of aware of. And it was that, and watching again a couple documentaries I marinated in that I love so much, Best of Enemies, Gore Vidal versus William F. Buckley, and Life Itself. And both were about like rivals and competition, and you know, when life happens, illness or something, that these people can almost become something you need, or this really interesting psychological idea that like you can be defined by your worst moments. You become like tied to these people because like you soiled your reputation trying to take them down. And all that was really interesting to me. So that, along with, you know, the, in our country, in the US, like the rapid changes that we were seeing, that was kind of enough. I felt like I had enough ingredients to write something that was achievable as a first feature.
Nice. And how long did it take you to write?
Oh my gosh. Like, I've probably rewritten it 50 to 60 times. Realistically, I would say it was probably 2 to 3 years, like 17 to 20 or so. And then it was, my dad passes away. I write Pinwheel Horizon. So there was two phases to it. It was probably 2 to 3 years to write it. And then it went on the shelf for like 2 years. And it wasn't until I was in post-production on my third short that I pulled it off and read it and was like, okay, yeah, I think I would try to make this now. And there was a little bit of rewriting after, but not much. It was pretty, I was actually surprised. There's a monologue at the end that Patrick Fabian gives about what it feels like when people die. That's the only thing I added. And that was after my dad, my only sibling, and my mom passed in 3 subsequent years, from 19 to 21. So ironically, I had written this script about grief with only the anticipatory grief of, my dad's been sick my whole life, he's going to die first, and he did. Brother in a freak car accident, and mom the year following, not in the cards, right? So it was very weird to like put it on the shelf and focus on my third short, and then come back to it and read it with like, this is weirdly predictive of, it's very much, I didn't write it to be as, I guess the best way to say it is, you know, I never like to be precious of like putting too much of myself in my stuff. I think that's a little like, for one, I just don't want to relive it. And I like to have an imagination and reassign things. But it was surprising reading it after that, feeling like, you know, it's not me, but like, yeah, I really resonate with this, you know. And like, I was trying to write the most unsavory protagonist I could think of, like after Me Too and Black Lives Matter, you know, straight white old guys that are atheists, like collectively in North America, we don't give them, they're not sort of anyone's favorite or something. And for that reason, I was like, cool, that's my guy. we gotta like, I'm gonna try to humanize the least among us or whatever. But it was weird how much, someone asked me this recently, and I was like, yeah, I relate to it more than I'm comfortable with. Anyway, yeah.
That's I'm sorry about your family, and that's eerie to hear in a way, like that
Thank
you
you.
were you had this you were giving yourself the medicine kind of from an earlier point.
Isn't it weird? It is really strange to me. Yeah. And that is also, you know, it to I mean to this is true. If had my brother not had this freak accident, you know, my mom passing, we would have two siblings, we would have split, you know, what we sold of her house. And you know, when you finish up someone's estate. So it's literally in his absence that I was able to make it. So there's a lot of, it's hard for me in a way that I feel grateful for. I try to be careful to not do the, you know, quixotic thing that you were talking about, like the conquest of like, oh, well, this happened because of these reasons. But they're also, yeah, I'm aware of like the sort of really rare, surprising things that had to sort of add up to give me the opportunity to make it. Yeah, so I feel really feel grateful about that. And that also, you know, those three people who I love, not as I told my wife, like I could never ask them, what are you passionate about? It would have been a fight because it was such a house that was stuck in ways and defined by what they were against, basically. And I was, you know, this shiny object of the artistic kid, which a lot of us artists feel in families where like we're still welcome, but it's, we get that like side eye thing, you know, like when our language around politics and religion changes, you know, it's like they don't know how to quantify us. So it kind of like, I like it now that there feels like there's some, you know, low-key cosmic baton passing to like, because like my brother really believed in me and was always a big fan of the thing, and I don't know how it all works, but yeah, I feel really fortunate to get to make something out of all of that loss that's weirdly about loss.
Wow. Yeah. Next questions are going to be how you got the film off the ground and funding and all of that. Cause that's the hugest thing for an independent film. It's like, where's the money coming from?
Yeah. Questions I'm asking right now about what I want to make next, which is, yeah. You know, like Tarantino, when he's talking about scripts, but he's like, we gotta be willing to go back down the mountain, you know, and start over. And gosh, that is the feeling of like, whether it's the next story or, oh man, this is such a bigger budget than the way we speak. And I feel that this isn't true, but the feeling is I'm doing this again for the first time. Do you kind of know what I mean? It's like, I know I was there for all of it. I've definitely learned things, but it really does feel like, boy, it's starting again. So yeah, all stuff I will be trying to figure out.
That's great. It means you're not repeating yourself, you know, you're taking on a new challenge because you're like, well, it's another feature, yeah, but it's going to be totally different. And
that's a good way to, you're right, yeah, it is nice.
Yeah.
And it's so funny, there's definitely trade-offs to everything where I was like, you know, we've heard the horror stories of executive producers who, you know, the filmmakers would say no money was worth how problematic they were in terms of like tinkering or this or that, like, but having it privately funded, you know, word gets around cast and crew, and then, you know, they're, you know, you can run into things where like, yeah, it feels people aren't treating it like a normal film set because it's sort of, they think it's like this homegrown thing, so people can get a little fast and loose. So it's weird. And in that way, I think you're right. I'm like, yeah, it's a good challenge to do the next one differently because, yeah, there's always challenges.
Yeah. Whether it's like too much money, what a challenge. No.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, creativity comes out of certain constraints and, you know, just in stepping forward. And I mean, you worked with Patrick Fabian on this film and he's quite a name actor, and that must have been a challenge for you, but also adding a certain gravitas to the set and like making the feature possible through getting a name. I'm curious about how that all came together.
I was a huge fan. Again, Erie, my brother was. So I told my brother to watch Better Breaking Bad, and he does and falls in love with it. And then he told me to watch Better Call Saul. And for some reason, although it was in that universe, I was like, I don't know. And I think we started it and stopped. And it was, eventually came back to it, watched for 6 seasons, never thought of Patrick Fabian. The script had existed throughout the run of that show. He never occurred to me as Simon until what I believe is his character's second to last episode, where he was like, he thinks he's getting a mediator in this really great long payoff that they've written. And what he doesn't know he's doing is like kind of participating in his own undoing. And he's basically being set up by the two leads. And what I saw in that scene was like, they gave this character, who we always thought was an antagonist, they gave him a real like human outro. And it was watching him sort of start to relish getting someone, which was beneath the character. And that he was kind of undoing his own reputation. That was the light bulb moment of like, oh my gosh, that's Simon. Like, he could totally do this. And it was very like DIY at that point. We were trying to make it in Washington. So it was me and my a consulting producer. And the little that I knew was like, try to get to a manager if you can, because agents will be more focused on the bottom line. So I called the manager, and I had a little bit in, a little bug in my ear from marketing, which, have spent years in that as a copywriter, and the idea of rather than ask for something, try to give someone something. So I tried that, and it was, fortunately sincere. I got his manager on the phone and was like, hey, I kind of like told him, I think I really understand Patrick as an actor, just finished Better Call Saul. I think that he did this really well, and I have this script I've written, and here are the ways that I think it would be really interesting for him as sort of a next step. And he read it, and then Patrick read it, and I think we were filming like 6 months later. So that's one of those weird, I don't have many experiences that go that smoothly. Like everything is hard won. That was one of those like. And if he were on, he would tell you, well, I just really liked your script. It was funny at the wrap party, he was like, he didn't know it was my first feature. And I was like, dude, why did you risk, what if I edit this and make you look terrible? And he's like, I liked your script. So that's nice to hear. But I have AJ, my director of photography, we talked recently, and I was like, whoever we have on the next one, we should temper ourselves to know that not only did we get the guy who made this character work, but he as an individual has been, we are so fortunate. We could have run into like, I've been in this business 30 years, diva thing, or talk to my agent about the film. Like he's been so enthusiastically supportive. And him and I happened to get on really well from an early point. I'm almost like day two, that I'm kind of relishing it and trying to like, hey, Ian, you may need to learn how to direct someone who's there for the paycheck next time. You never know, and they might be great, but like, yeah, we've been really fortunate. We continue to be. Like, we got into Anchorage International, and he's gonna come all the way from London to Alaska with me to show it in December. So he just continues to be like kind of a special human being. In a way that's nice, because I'm new.
That's wonderful. I mean, your shorts have you work with the same actors multiple times in your shorts, so you clearly have a keen sense for good people to work with because you keep working with them. And I think it's a good lesson for filmmakers, for independent filmmakers. You're like, actors just want a good script, and take the shot, reach out. Like if the script is good, like chances are they won't care about the money. And if someone cares about the money, then they won't work with you, and then great. Like,
Our casting director, Dee at Vice, has a great line, and she says like no is a complete sentence, which I love, because like I'm a recovering pleaser, so, but it is so helpful. Like sometimes we get so scared of this like ominous outcome, and it's like the worst thing is going to be no, you know, it's just no, it doesn't, it's not, you know, and I probably spent a lot of time, like, as you were saying about Simon, in my own head, but to just actually like take the steps. And it's like, we submitted to an actor prior to Patrick, and, you know, we got through the 2 weeks with the agent and they read it and considered it and they passed, and it was like, cool. We didn't insult them. That was a great lesson. It was just, yeah, I am someone who's really good at working up the fearful worst scenario. And I find, for me personally, the only antidote is to just take steps. And it's like, it never goes like that, even if it doesn't work out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any anxiety, like, of not being ready to make a feature, that you were biting off more than you can chew? I mean, obviously you made several shorts very competently, but was there any sort of nerves there? You're like, oh, I need to just make another shorter, and I'm not quite ready for this.
The honest answer is no. I like the way it sounds to say yes, because, you know, it sounds a little arrogant or something, but, you know, we could get like a little diagnose me, like, I have ADHD, like, I feel good in certain environments, like, and like what I consider high stakes, high stress environments, like, I feel good in. So, I don't know. I've always kind of trusted my, like, kind of my taste and way of navigating with people. And I just, you know, the easiest way to say it is, like, I like myself in that environment. And which isn't to say, like, I come in with, like, you know, like marching orders for everybody, but yeah, I like collaborating and being challenged, you know, and all those actors did, by the way. The film's much better because each of those 5 to 7 actors at the top of the ensemble not only had great taste, but like, we really fell into a rapport, and like, they A, really believed in the story and where it was headed, but B, would have little things of like, this moment doesn't make any sense. And everything they came up with was better. So yeah, when you're lucky enough to be with people that are talented, and, you know, this I kind of, you know, credit to God on, because I can't cast on a personality. I'm only judging on the performance they give. And fortunately, like, none of us felt territorial, which is one of those, like, you know, every once in a while we watch things, you know, this as a filmmaker, and you're like, there's so many little things that could have gone so much worse. You know, and like, I could have had all great performers that were just really territorial, or for whatever reason, I couldn't receive their feedback because I felt threatened, and we would have been screwed. So my answer to feeling like confident and not nervous, you know, it's partially that I feel good in that atmosphere. But I mean, the people that you're working with will make or break that, you know, every day of the week. So yeah, I feel. And speaking of AJ Marson, my DP, I mean, his first feature, miraculously, it looks like a $2.5 million movie. And that guy elevated, and we fell into such a, just a wonderful, it's one of my favorite creative collaborations ever. Just, you know, spent hundreds of hours on the shot list, did like a tech scout, and then for reasons I won't tell you, to protect, you know, certain names, you know, but as happens with indies a lot, oh, we've got 40 minutes left on our shooting day to shoot like a 2.5-page scene. So we're throwing out all of this hundreds of hours of work, and we're putting on the dolly, and we're going to push in, and it's just going to be a single shot. And it was this combination of him being like rigorously meticulous and us both not being territorial and being like, I don't know, let's move the camera a little bit, you know, like tilt it like 30 degrees that way. And he'd be like, oh, cool. So it was just this really, you know, those are actually, I think, the people that get credit for why I felt really good. Because, you know, it's that whole safe thing.
Mm.
You don't sense that, yeah, you don't, you know, if any of us smell like ulterior motives or something, that's really quickly like, wow, I'm in, you know, I'm one of the leaders on this set, but, you know, like, the fangs are out. That's a super, you know, that's like kryptonite to creativity. It just kills it.
Yeah, because, you know, especially working with actors, you know, they do so much prep work, and their responsibility is holding on to the integrity of the character. So, you know, if a writer director isn't interested in listening to an actor's feedback when they're saying like, this doesn't feel quite right, then, you know, you're like, you hired this person to embody this character. And as a writer, like, you know, we create these characters, but like, there's also a life beyond what we've created and these layers and layers. And so it's such a gift when an actor comes to you or, right. you know, anyone on your set and you're like, this isn't quite working. And you got to go like, yes, thank you. Like, how do we make this work?
I'm so with you, Kelly. And I know you've heard these horror stories too of like directors who take the opposite approach and just feel, you know, you hear these stories of, oh, it was horrible. I couldn't get a word in. And he did more roles than was his to do and felt threatened. And it's shocking to me because you can even not do that from a selfish perspective of it's pain now or pain later. Like it is uncomfortable to collaborate and be corrected, but like your thing's getting better. If you don't do that and you sort of like resist these amazing actors who are as exactly as you say, they do the work and they immediately know the characters better than at least me as a writer, then in some day you're gonna be watching your film and you're gonna be like, oh shoot, you know, this was like an army of one and now it's an inferior thing. Like I'm with you. I can't get my head around the reasons why people want to direct and write. And you know, I haven't met it, but I've heard the stories of just utterly unavailable for collaboration. And I'm like, one does not belong with the other. It's very weird to me.
Filmmaking is just the best team sport.
Right. Yeah. And it's a little scary to think they're going through that with the delusion of this was all me, you know, when by definition it was, would not exist without a huge group of people.
Yeah.
It's a weird one. How is Vancouver, and I know you're in Burnaby, but like, how is the scene? Like we in Washington, we believe we're like the bastard child because Oregon, where we filmed The Way We Speak, and Vancouver, like we know that their tax incentives are so much more robust. Does it feel good and busy? Because like down here, we're hearing things like even LA isn't doing anything. Like, How is filmmaking in Canada feel to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm hearing the same things about LA, that no one's buying anything, that people are leaving. And I know up here, at least for actors, it's been a little bit slow. Apparently it's picking up, but it's a very interesting scene here because we're a billion-dollar service industry. So serving the American productions that come up. So there's a huge number of people who are trained to do below the line jobs. And then there's also a huge number of storytellers who are crafting their own stories. But for us to get funding to say do a feature film, it's a much smaller pot. You know, we don't have these big studios that are funding projects. There's some government funding. And then of course people do what they can to get private funding, but it's not yeah, it's interesting. So we have a thriving independent community here that is so incredible. Some of my friends run a competition called Run and Gun. It's like a 48-hour film race, which my film that played at Gig Harbor with The Way We Speak was done in that film race.
Yeah, the 48-hour. I can't believe you pulled that off. 48 hours. It's much better than the typical quality of 48 hours.
Oh, my God. But you wouldn't believe, like, there was over 2,000 filmmakers that participated in this film race. Yeah. I think, like, 149 films. And the quality and the production value, like, my film was a scrappy little project. You know, I was doing my own sound. But there's people out there who are, you know, there's crew of dozens, sound stages, like, VFX, like, just mind-blowing what people are pulling off in 48 hours up here. Like the quality of the talent here in Vancouver is surreal. But there's very little funding to go above that. And people are doing it. People are making features and they're figuring it out. But it's definitely, yeah, it's like we're our own weird bastard child where we're like, you know, there's this huge community of independent filmmakers making shorts and sketches. And then it's like, okay, well, how do we get up here? And so I feel like maybe with this exodus from LA and this just general shift, I'm hoping that we're going to see like an opening for people to keep making more content here and it getting broader distribution and more eyes. But it's a weird sort of tension here where there's so much creativity bursting and not enough places to go.
That resonates. I mean, yeah, Seattle feels similar, even though like the makeup's different. This sense of a very low ceiling, you know what I mean? And like everybody's, there's no shortage of talent, but like you can, yeah, it's kind of like you get capped at shorts and it's very, maybe increasingly hard for people to find their way around that, which is scary, but here we go. We'll figure it out.
Well, I love being at Gig Harbor, which is just an hour south of Seattle, and meeting all of these incredible filmmakers from Washington and all over, but specifically meeting people from Washington and just feeling so excited and being like, damn, I wish I could collaborate with you. But there's this lousy border in the way that like makes it a little bit more difficult for us to come together when like, why shouldn't we be building this larger community where we're sharing resources and sharing talent and collaborating? Because, I mean, that's my dream.
It's mine too. And not just saying this, like you and I have already talked and we can talk more offline, but like I wrote my next feature to be set in Northern Alberta and I want to make it in Canada. So yeah, I would like those borders to be, I mean, it's funny. I have almost only Devil Needs a Fix that I make in Seattle. The first and third shorts were made in Eastern Washington and the way we speak mostly in Portland. I feel better. I think it's almost that good thing of like, you know, how you feel when you travel, when you're a little off of your, you know, you don't quite have sea legs and it's kind of exciting. I think it's like good for creativity. Like you're not too in your element, you know? So hopefully I get to make this next thing in Canada, which I've ridden my motorcycle through a bunch, like all the way to the Yukon, and I'm weirdly in love with Canada. So yes, I'm hoping to exploit it for my film.
come do it. Yes. I'm curious thematically where your next feature is going.
It is an unapologetic ghost story, which is my, yeah. So it's also based on nonfiction stuff, but I was realizing in all, I think at least three of my four films, like feature or short, I have been a big fan of misdirection, which I know I like. And even if that's just like the sort of not satisfying on the promise of the synopsis, you know, that it's your thing. It's the third way, you know, and wanting to challenge myself. So this is not that. This has like an undead woman and it's not possession, which I think is unbelievably tired. And it's not like, you know, oh, it was all a dream thing. It's like very different people have to contend with this, you know, my version of Jaws, like cutting through the film. So yeah, it's very genre for me, which is surprising. I'm like, I've made more genre stuff than I would have guessed. Cause what I tend to watch is like documentaries and, you know, pretty like earnest dramas, but yeah, I'm into it, but it's out there for me.
Nice. That's exciting. I love it. That's really exciting.
Well, yeah, if you're interested, I'm gonna do a polish. The screenplay's done. I'm gonna do a polish, and then if you want to read it, I'd love to talk with you more about it. Either way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be honored. Very cool. Does it have a title? Are you willing to share?
Not willing to share.
Perfect.
I'm so superstitious. I'm like, no, just keep it down low. But
Untitled Northern Alberta Ghost Story.
Yeah. Exactly.
Perfect.
Oh, sorry.
No, I was just gonna say this has been so great.
Oh, I'm so glad. I love the podcast. I love the kind of waters you're swimming in. Yeah, and I agree with what you were saying earlier. I think it's kind of a collective disservice to not wrestle with these kind of things. You know, as uncomfortable as they can be, given the baggage that we all bring to them. I still think a lot of these like bigger issues, you know, are like not done with us, you know, and if we're done with them, we can make our existence a little shallow. So that's my read anyway. I know that we all have seasons and sometimes it's like, all I can do is like, you know, go to work and have a warm bath and like push it all out because I can't handle it. Like all the grace in the world for that. But like over the trajectory, I feel like this is kind of the stuff that is worth wrestling with.
Absolutely. I've been thinking a lot about karma and trying to understand like the concept itself. And currently I'm understanding it as like the wheel. Like in tarot, there's a card called the Wheel of Fortune, and there's associations to different lineages that suggest that like once certain things are in motion, they have to play out. And you know, some people could maybe look at that as like God's hand, or our own participation in free will, but it feels very much like, you know, I look around, I'm like, oh, the story of the world will express itself without our consent. Like the things that have been placed in motion, these God narratives, these political narratives, these war stories that we're living under, like they're going to keep playing out. And, you know, we can go and we should go and take a warm bath sometimes. Absolutely. Like regulate our nervous systems, but like we can't live in the bath.
Right. Totally. Yep.
You know, we totally have to keep working with those stories. And that's what I've appreciated about your work so much is the way that you're holding these narratives and allowing people to bring their own things to the table and asking more questions than providing answers. I feel like in my own work, it's been a bit more like needing people to understand my perspective, which I think is a valid way to tell a story. And yet ultimately that can lead to more division. It can make people feel seen or not seen, and that's going to comfort them or it's going to provoke them, and you know, take that as you will. But I really love this way of storytelling that just kind of just offers people so much to work with, where it's not prescriptive. It's just here's some things that we're working with that we need to keep working with. And now go have a discussion or like go dream about this or go journal about it or whatever it is. But like, here are these little things that are going to poke you and we're going to keep discussing this as a collective.
Wow. That's really kind of you. And I, from my opinion, I feel like your work's doing that. Like, I mean, your podcast and your films, I know we're always our own toughest critic, but I really feel like you swim in those waters. And I was watching the first of the year two that I saw, feeling impressed and not feeling like it was prescriptive. It was challenging in the way that I like. And like we were saying in the beginning, kind of feel like has gone missing, you know, it seems like a lot of, there's obviously like the big tentpole spectacle stuff, which is what it is. Or the stuff that seems like is afraid to say anything. Or the most it could do was talk itself into kind of reinforcing what we would expect, you know, and we kind of smell it in the first couple minutes. And by the end, we're like, yep, that definitely was about what I thought it was going to be about. So I get it. But yeah, I like how you articulate that. And I think, I don't know, I like to hope that there's more people like us that are like, you know, aware that we're still on that journey and want to plug into places that are helping us along with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Here's to continuing to grapple with the unknown.
Yeah, for sure.
Amazing. So people can watch The Way We Speak on Apple, right? It's streaming in Canada on Apple, I know. Is it the same in the States?
Yeah, it should be everywhere that it is in the US, up in Canada. So Apple, Amazon, and then on October 23rd, will be like wider. So if people are subscribed to Amazon Prime already, it will go from being like, I need to rent it to it will become free for Prime people on Amazon. And then we'll be out on like Sling TV and Tubi and one other that I've like never heard of. But basically like we're going to be on the SVOD platforms as of October 23rd, meaning even more wide and available. So not just like on demand rent or buy, but like, you know, if you are already paying for Sling, you'll be able to find our movie.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, I know. We should be running that. I'm a little behind.
Hey, you got a week. I mean, we're recording this on October 16th, and so perhaps we'll release it.
Yeah, I'm going to go to this festival this weekend and then come back, and I'm like, I need to put that up because people will want to. Yeah, I'm a little behind.
Yeah. Is Tubi, is that the free, is a free one?
Yes. Yeah. And like, I mean, I have tech overload, so I get a little like, it's all the same. But yeah, I believe that's the one of the more prominent free ones. There might be commercials or something, but we'll be on that. And like Sling, I know, because we get it sometimes. Like, you know, it's basically cheaper Hulu, and we'll just be one of the movies that you can pull up in there.
Well, that's wonderful. It's going to reach so many more audiences. That's huge.
I hope so. Yeah, it's weird to like, I don't know if you have this issue where, you know, you can kind of like check in to like Letterboxd and And I do this way too much to like I need more to clearly do with my time, but it's not a life to be like, but it's hard to until you get those like for us quarterly statements from the distributor, or we're at a festival like where you and I met. I have no, there's no way to quantify, which drives me crazy.
Yes.
So it you're absolutely right. It will be a bigger audience, and it'll be nice to start getting some feedback. Financials aside, just on like how many eyeballs are on this? Because it's weird to like launch and just kind of, wait.
Yeah, you're like, it's just out there in the void. Is
Yeah.
anybody there?
You don't hear anything. It was very weird. I was depressed in August because it's like we were saying about festivals, like the other side of any, we worked up and we did the publicity and it's out. And then it was so crickets that I was, then you get in your own head and then that's bad.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that. I don't know what you're talking about, Ian. Never once have I checked a metric on my content.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, oh, yeah, I can definitely like it's the equivalent of like just the endless Instagram scrolling where I'm like, I know this is not, I will not leave this experience feeling better in terms of my mental health. And here I am doing it. And same, it's like, dude, if you check that again, you're gonna drive your own problem.
We are the mountain. We are our own mountains.
Sure.
But that's amazing. I'm so glad that it's going to be out there. And I wish for you just creative inspiration to keep you occupied and not checking your metrics. But
Thank
I'm
you so
right
much.
there with you.
Yeah, it's a good problem that I know I need to rewrite the scripts because that's the like, I'm lazy. I always want to be at the top of the pyramid, like it's done, and then when I'm act two needs to pop, it's not popping. So when I come back, I have a good problem to sink my teeth into. And then, yeah, I want to talk about it.
Yes. And
Awesome.
so your production company is called Broken Telegraph, and people can watch the rest of your shorts on your website, which is
Broken
Ian.
Telegraph.
Yeah.
BrokenTelegraph.com is probably the easiest. Otherwise, they're going to have to know the titles to search for them on like Vimeo and YouTube. Yeah. So Broken Telegraph has the shorts and the trailer for The Way We Speak. And then The Way We Speak is increasingly everywhere.
Yes. And it's fine. I made a note about this and we didn't talk about it. And we'll wrap this up in a second. But I find it's really interesting the name of your production company.
Oh, thanks.
Because the
Yeah.
telegraph
Yeah.
is about communication. It's like
Yeah.
messaging device, right? Like
Totally. Yeah, I've never had like a good, I still don't have a good like answer for why I named it that, but it's always felt good. It was actually the name of back when I was blogging on Faith and Human Rights, that was the name of my site. And now it's like a company and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's exactly what you said. And there's a little religious hangover of, I like the idea that like, we get in our own way, but we still, those of us who are writers or creatives or artists, like we still have a, I don't know, whatever the lofty word is, duty or responsibility to like, say something despite our own shortcomings. I like that idea. Plus, this is my wife's fault. I'm getting more and more interested in history. So, I don't know, just these old things that like don't matter anymore in terms of communication. I don't know. I feel a little romantic for that. So there's some of that in the title.
I totally get that. And it's just like gesturing to the imperfectness of language and communication. And,
Yeah. Plus,
it's.
and honestly, at the end of the day, this as a writer, like, Aaron Sorkin calls it like the musicality. I just like the way it sounds. Like sometimes you just put two words together and you're like, that's my bad robot. I like the way that sounds. Yeah.
Nice.
Like I can make up lofty reasons for why it's called that later, but I just like those two words together. So
And it'll be emergent, right? It's like these things are kind of like you write a script or you create a title or like whatever, and then it's only later that you're like, oh.
that weird? Well, you said the water thing, and seriously, I'm like, I have no idea. But Brendan, yeah, I was like, that's really cool. I have no concept of why that's so prevalent in my last two stories, but it is weirdly prevalent.
Yeah. Well, I think
So.
and it exists in the collective consciousness, and there are these archetypical icons, they hold weight, they hold water,
Yeah.
in our psyche, whether we recognize it or not. And these things just will often emerge, and it's like, oh, that's so thematically correct, or like it resonates so much with someone. And I love that. I think that's the beautiful, one of the beautiful things about storytelling, when we can get out of our own way and let something come through and you're like, oh, I never could have written something so powerful or like suggested something so perfectly parallel, but like it just came through and it makes complete sense.
It's amazing. I'll leave you with, I know we got to go. If you ever Google James Lipton interviewing Spielberg, there's a great example of that where like in James Lipton's question to Spielberg, he reveals something that Spielberg hasn't known has been a connection point for him for like decades. And Spielberg's like, wow, yep, it's really, really cool.
Oh, amazing. That sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Ian. This has been such a delight.
Oh, it's been so great. Thanks for having me on, Kelly.